sights to show you.
My glorified ashtray, which is a soda can
right
now.
It's a soda can? Great. Oh, this is, we're living it up. Oh.
Have you ever been to Anthony's place, Alex?
Oh, yes, yeah. Many times.
Many times.
It's a horror movie in and of
yes,
itself.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
The second I went there, I was like, I can see why you do this podcast now. This place is terrifying.
Yes, absolutely. It's like wonderful. Every time I walked, yeah, every time.
That hallway is pretty creepy.
Every time.
Yeah, that hallway is.
No, the whole place. Everything about it. I feel like people have definitely been murdered in that place.
Oh, no. There's definitely been, like, dead homeless people outside. Not directly outside, but, like, you know, towards the freeway. We hear reports. Yeah.
No, but I mean intentional murder has happened. Like, there's been some crazy shit in that building.
Apparently, my roommate discovered that there's, like, a second apartment behind, like, a closet that is completely empty.
Fuck that
and just filled
shit.
With shit and, like, cobwebs and stuff. And, yeah, he, like, discovered it just, like,
putting
in your stuff
place.
Away. Yeah, that our place that connects to a second apartment that has, like, nothing in it. Yeah, Alex is saying words. So I'm like, listen out for her right now.
I can kind of hear her.
What happened? What was that, Alex?
No, I was just
going to
say, there was this, like, there's this phenomenon in, like, New York.
Oh, yes.
It's like, slumlord logic, like the Candyman thing, where, like, there will be apartments attached by mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get to the other apartment right.
Yeah, you can shimmy
off.
Your way in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen a video of them doing that. And it's like
through
it's like a
mirror?
Big place.
Well, and it was based
you like open
off
a
of,
mirror?
Like, that's what Candyman was based off of. Because there was like a rapist who would go like from apartment to apartment through other apartments.
Oh, that's so weird. That's scary.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I feel like that is a really good segue into what we're about to talk about.
That's right, see? Oh, you didn't have your headphones in. Kathleen transitioned it right there.
Fuck. Well, I'll take your word for it.
let's just go.
This is going to be a delight. Okay, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex Webster. With me, as always...
Very, very key can open right there. Nice.
...is Anthony Fuentes.
Oh, hey, everybody. And by the way, I am... It's a return of the Anthony Fuentes hungover episode.
Yeah,
but it's been a few months.
It's gonna be a little fun.
Yeah, no, it's gonna be great because we have a special guest.
Yes,
my good old friend Kathleen. How you doing?
Hello, hey. I am great. How about you guys?
I'm sorry, I got ibuprofen in me.
He's hungover.
Oh, and the weed too.
Yeah, and
what's gonna happen?
I don't know. I think
light it up
for you. They might cancel each other.
I think they are. I think we're just gonna feel real nice because I'm feeling a little better already. Hey, all right, cool.
So, we're sharing a joint. How are you?
Great. As you guys know, we just had a little pre-talk session.
Yeah, we warmed up very nice.
But warmed up nice. I took a couple of edibles about 15 minutes ago or 30 minutes ago.
Okay.
So it should hit me in about 10 minutes.
I'm
excited.
As our other friend, Caitlin, who listens to this podcast, hi, Caitlin, always says you have to activate it by saying this edible ate shit and then it immediately starts working. And that's how you have to activate it.
Really?
Oh.
Interesting methodology.
That's some magic there I hadn't heard about.
The second you say this edible isn't working or this edible ain't shit, you immediately
it starts working.
Launched into the stratosphere.
No, just when I have that thought, it's usually within like 5 minutes. I'm like, oh, you know, I took a little bit of go. Maybe it's a little lit. And then just fucking
and then
right
you're
there.
Gone.
And I'm just like, hey, I'm not going anywhere today.
That's the thing with edibles is like I finally found this brand that hits me at a really perfect point because before all edibles were like either I died and I just fell asleep or I didn't feel anything ever. So I finally found this little brand and I love it. And in fear of product promotion kind of issues, I'm not going to bring up what it is. But
you should tell me later
really
because
like
I have the same problem and I'm trying to find like that like happy middle.
I found one that like. Was so latent, I would have that thought, right? I'd go to sleep thinking, like, oh, the edibles and shit, and
I wake up
stoned.
You'd wake up
like, wake up so, like, whoa, good thing I did it on Saturday. Good thing I did it on Saturday.
Yeah. I know that feeling all too well. Like, okay, I have a day to recover from this. We're fine. We're going to be good.
I don't know if I can even talk about this on the show, but I used to, like, take edibles at work.
Oh, no.
Oh,
wait,
no.
One of those jobs that you, like, don't, you know.
Well, no, it was at one of my longer places of employ, but it was such a high stress environment that I was like, you know what, I deserve this. Yeah. And we all did it. It was great.
But, as long as you're not operating heavy machinery.
I work in marketing.
It's getting you. It's getting you, Kathleen. I can tell.
I was like, no, they're going to think I'm stoned already. Uh-oh. That was just a mishap.
You're like, no, that was supposed to be a Sean Connery impression. I'm sorry.
Okay. The only time I'll ever be able to do it is accidental, so it's perfect.
But Kathleen, as the new guest, as the first timer here, you get to introduce us. What are we talking about today?
Okay, well, we're talking about the movie The Strangers.
That's right.
Which is about 2008. It's a young couple staying in an isolated vacation home. They are terrorized by three unknown assailants.
Yeah.
This is written and directed. Oh, should I continue?
No,
I don't know.
Going.
What's the process?
Keep going. You're fine. Yeah, you're good.
Written and directed.
Document good. You're fine.
You read document good. Written and directed by.
Oh, it's gonna be fun. No, we're good.
All right. One last final time. It's written and directed by Brian Bertino, right? That's how you say it?
Yeah,
no.
Sure.
I don't know. Every time I read it, I was like, I feel like there's some kind of intonation in there that I'm not reading.
Bertino.
I know. I was thinking like super Italian. Like,
yeah.
Right? Like, what should I do with this? Whatever. Okay. And it's starring, obviously, Liv Tyler. And Scott Biedman, Liv Tyler, a gem of the 90s and early 2000s.
A true gem, but also...
A true gem.
Oh, gosh. We're going to talk about it.
We're going to talk about it. Okay, good. I'm glad we're going to talk about it. Okay, and then the box office numbers, the budget was $9 million. Release date was May 30th of 2008. And it grossed $82
million. Damn, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
For like $9 million.
I think it is. Huh? For a horror movie?
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, that's pretty good. All right.
Oh, God.
We're back. We're fine.
Okay.
Again, I'm a little hungover, people. And
it's all good.
A lot of different influences happening right now.
Yeah,
so.
There's like... I'm feeling good.
But we're here. So a big thing about this movie from 2008 is that cue, that little title card in the beginning that says it's based on true events.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what the actual events were, if there were. I don't know.
I'm gonna hijack this because it's also suspected to be based off of another true crime thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Another true crime story.
Yeah.
So you're gonna go through yours,
and then I'm gonna
go through mine.
Okay. All right. I want to hear it. Perfect.
I love this emergence with My Favorite Murder because that is my all-time favorite podcast, and I love that. This is where this is going. Okay.
Oh my gosh, we are doing a My Favorite Murder moment. Okay.
Oh, this is great.
I love it.
All right. Well.
I love it. I hope they see this.
So, of course, the Strangers opens up with an ominous voiceover that claims this film is based on true events. And I'm going to go ahead and say eerie? Sure. Factually correct sentence? It's pretty debatable. It's actually pretty debatable. So, The Strangers was originally titled The Faces.
That's stupid as fuck.
Yeah. That's
which is so ironic considering what ends up actually happening. Right. But I love that that's what it was called.
One letter change away from The Feces. There you go.
So. Thank you for your third grade boy humor.
It was the third screenplay that the director Bertino, was it Brian Bertino, had ever written.
Yeah.
And it was his love letter to 70s horror films, which he actually watched a lot as a child. And it was influenced by his own claim, two incidents, the Manson family murders and a strange incident that actually happened at his front door when he was a little child. Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, what made the acts of violence from Manson's followers stick out to him was just how many details were actually available to the public about the case. And with that, what the victims had actually gone through over the course of one night. So,
that's got to be such a crazy moment, though, to, like, actually live through the Manson murders. Like, I feel like us, our generation, we know so much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine, like, living in that time, hearing about these crazy things that were going on.
Right?
Just like that must have caused such hysteria. And imagine as being like a little kid living through that. Like, how does that then change your relationship to just crime in general and horror? And it's crazy.
Like, I'm thinking about it like for like me. Okay, so I don't know if you know this, Kathleen, but I'm significantly younger than Anthony.
By like
I'm younger.
Years.
Okay. Yeah, I'm 5 years younger than him.
Oh, okay.
So, I'm an oldie. I know. classic.
You've always been always
young
been
at heart.
Yes.
Anyway, so growing up for me, like, my relationship with crime was significantly different just because of just, like, you know, what was going on in terms of, you know, crime. I just got really high very fast.
I was like, what's going on, Alex?
Continue.
You're like, crime is a crime, yes.
Crime. But I was going to tie it back to...
Generational differences
and watching, like, true crime TV and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And how, like, the end of, like, the serial killer in terms of, like, because of social media and because of just, like, general TV access. Mm-hmm. And the influx of true crime stuff that the serial killer is kind of... different now than
it's
what we got in the
70s. It's not as sacred as it was before.
Or like what we got in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. You don't have, like, iconic killers at this point. You know, I got Bundys and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the 90s too, but it was just the fact that, like, serial killers were everywhere. Like, mm-hmm. that was the idea, that they would always, like, as a kid, learning in Brownies. I was literally in Girl Scouts.
Yeah.
And they were telling us how, like, they're training us. Like, if you're at a mall, like, you're with all your Brownie friends, like, you know, we have the buddy system, but in case something happens and someone grabs you, your responsibility as a 7-year-old child was to throw your ass on the ground and say, "You're not my mommy!" Because it's much harder to kidnap you if you're on the ground and resisting.
Oh.
That's a legit something I learned as a young kid.
Oh, God.
The metagame. It's truly changed over the decades.
Yeah. Like, that just reminds me of, like, the Bobby Hill, like,
"Oh, I don't know you. That's my purse."
Yeah.
"I don't know you."
Yeah. Well, that was just so true of the times. That's what kids had to do and were told to do. So, and I feel like that comes from this, though. That's because our parents that told mm-hmm. us to do that mm-hmm. lived through the Manson stuff. Well, where it was like anything could happen. This horrible, horrible shit happens in a suburban area to anyone at any point randomly.
It's not like
people were well involved or knew each other. Yeah. So that really plays into this movie. Like, it makes sense that was his motivation.
He actually has a quote about this. So that's right to the next point we're on, because it was the randomness that really, really stuck out to it. So in his words, actually, some quote. He says, "You read obituaries every day where someone is killed for a random reason. Yes, mm-hmm. we may eventually find out why, but sometimes they don't. And the fact that a lot of this stuff kind of can go by the wayside, or you have to wait before you find out the results."
Mm-hmm. Or you just never actually know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. like the it's not like the mess that they found as police officers was just so crazy that it was like, we're just going to theorize, but nobody's going to fucking know.
That's right.
There's no way to really know. Unless the killer professes or something, there's no way.
And even then, like, we really all know at this point, they have such a tendency to, like, dress things up and mm-hmm. be like, "I did this because of this this reason." And it's just like, "No, you didn't, little bitch."
They want that infamy. They want that infamy a lot of times, too.
They want to be Bundy.
But what reinforces this point also was an incident from his childhood, which involved mm-hmm. a streak of burglaries in his former neighborhood. So during this time, his family's home was essentially in the middle of nowhere, and on a night that his parents were out, because he was in, like, in the middle of Texas, like rural Texas is where he grew up. So very isolated comparatively.
I mean, I remember, or I am familiar.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar. Yeah, my family. I mean, Texas, rural Texas too. Yeah,
super,
your neighbors can be pretty far away.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of mm-hmm. the scary thing about it. Mm-hmm. But on a night when his parents were out, a group of strangers knocked on their door. His sister answered it, and the group simply asked if a person they claimed to be looking for lived there. His sister told him that they had the wrong address, and that just seemed like that. But later, he learned that that particular group, they made up the name, and they were actually a crew of burglars who were planning to rob their particular home if no one answered the door. So... yeah, that experience as a kid.
That's so crazy because, like, as latchkey kids mm-hmm. growing up, like, you're taught just never answer the door. Like, play dead.
Yeah.
Like, the lights are off, the TV goes off, you're not home. Like, don't answer the door. Like, no one's home ever.
But, I mean, this is from an era where, you know, parents would be like, "Oh yeah, cool. The kids are just outside for, like, the whole day. They'll come back eventually."
Right.
Yeah, before the sun's out.
The wilderness.
I had a little bit of that, but, like, next generation, not as much.
I had a weird combination of that.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in Northern California, and, like, we, like, huge backyards, and that, mm-hmm. like, that was just kind of, like, my life, where I was just, like, kind of run off into the woods. I mean, given it was, like, a backyard, and, like, you know, we were decently supervised, but, like, yeah, you'd go out and come back eventually, but it wasn't, like... I was being watched like a hawk or anything.
No, yeah, same. Very little supervision. I had like a Stranger Things upbringing. Like, we all had bikes. We'd go between neighborhoods and all of it. You knew all the routes between the houses and shit.
Yeah. I mean, I was the youngest, so like I always had people watching me kind of my whole life. I didn't really have babysitters as long because my older sisters then became my babysitters.
Oh, you were the youngest.
Wow. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about this last week about being like the older.
The oldest ones.
Yeah. And then just having to watch the younger siblings.
Very different for you guys, I can imagine.
Little shits. Yeah.
Gotta show them the spot. You do.
Anyways, back to bits. So this actually left this left a lasting impression on Bertino, which, coupled with influences from the book Helter Skelter, it helped create his third screenplay. And by the way, he first read Helter Skelter when he was only 11. So he had a fascination with this shit pretty early on. But he was satisfied with his work, and he entered it into a screenplay contest, which he actually totally won and immediately secured a deal with Universal. Ooh. So, in the blink of an eye...
Wow, that's so crazy.
Right?
That's so crazy.
I mean, that's
Hollywood. What luck.
That's fucking Hollywood. What luck. That's just... You could be just making shit money doing low-budget films, which was totally his career path at the time, and within like a week, it's like, okay, dude, you're studio financed now. There you go.
But it's like he was working toward that the whole time, you know? So that's what makes it crazy, is that it's just sheer luck sometimes. Right place, right moment.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not the what you know, it's the who you know type of thing. But even that, like, it's just dumb luck. Like, we talked about that. Yeah. We talked about that forever ago on the podcast. Like, it's it's that, it's talent, and then just, like, seriously, in so many cases, just, like, dumb luck.
Enough
luck.
Especially with
stat.
Horror.
Right. Well, like, right.
Your luck stat needs to be real high.
Yeah.
But it, well,
I feel like that speaks more to like the horror genre, right? Like
that's true.
That speaks to, because it's not like there are franchises you can build around horror. Like, it's not really like you can have big names that are going to be automatically drawn to scripts but via horror, because usually it sucks.
It's super niche too. Sometimes it's a shameful thing on a resume for an actor.
Yeah.
You know, like, I did a horror film back in whatever.
Right. Totally. And once you're in that, you're pigeonholed in that for some people. Mm-hmm. It's just not really a good path to, like, fandom or fame. It creates a lot of fandom, but, I mean, yeah.
Right.
It's odd. It's an odd little niche of things. So it makes sense that with horror specifically, you just have to get lucky.
It was that movie we did. Final Girls.
Yes.
Final Girls.
I was thinking about the Final Girls,
that's
too.
The basis for that. Because, yeah, the main actress, too, she had been pigeonholed as a slasher girl, right?
Right. Yeah. And she didn't want to be. Yeah. But now, I mean, depending on who you are, like, it's a badge of honor.
Yeah, if you get one of those like good new horror directors, get an Ari Aster. All those actors are, they're doing hot shit right now.
True.
Yeah.
Well, it was funny that Anthony, I think we were talking about this when I saw you. Was that like within horror? What people who understand and appreciate horror is that like you know someone who does it well is a diverse profile of an actor or of an artist.
That's true.
You know, especially as a director, if you can do horror well, you can probably do comedy well. You can probably do drama well. Like, it just really depends. But not everybody can be good at horror.
Yeah, because it's easy to do bad.
It doesn't work the other way around.
It's easy to do bad. We've covered some stinkers.
Well, I mean, I really like what you said, Kathleen, because it's very, very true. Horror, in terms of, like, comedic, like, in terms of timing, lends itself to comedy. And then in terms of just like caliber of acting can really lend itself to drama as well. So it kind of lends itself to other genres, but it doesn't work in the reverse way. Like, you can be a great comedy actor, but not blend as well into the horror genre.
No.
Unless you're Jordan Peele.
Unless you're Jordan Peele.
Yes.
Well, but there is a huge relationship between the two, though. Like,
absolutely.
The people who did American Horror Story, they did Glee.
What?
Like,
yes.
They did?
Yeah.
It's the same guy.
Yeah, and then what was the other one? Nip Tuck.
Oh, really?
Nip Tuck was the other one. Yeah,
he did Nip Tuck.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Hold on.
I'm pretty sure.
Good old FX.
Fucking FX. Hold on.
I'm gonna be writing.
Yeah. I know everybody's gotta figure it out now.
Okay, let's see. Ryan Murphy.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah. What else? Oh, fucking Ryan.
Notifications. Stop. pick up my phone once.
Okay, yeah, American Horror Story, Glee.
Program creator.
All the stuff I know. Who can find this faster? Okay, he did Scream Queens also.
He did Nip Tuck, yeah.
Oh, shit.
Program creator. He is right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. See?
Yeah.
There you go. But back to Brian Bertina, who's not as successful.
Right. So you talked about because growing up, I always had the association, and I was always told that The Strangers was based off of a different set of murders.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. That's right. I forgot about that. Yes.
We'll get to that. Sorry.
It's really fucking us up.
The Force Body episode is going to be a fucking nightmare.
Oh, it is.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Really sorry, guys. It took us off track.
No. Okay, so for me, I grew up in Northern California. This movie didn't come out until 2008, but it was, I don't know why, this was just kind of the deal. But have you ever heard of the Keddie murders?
That was in the research that came up.
Okay,
I missed it, though.
A fucking crazy person.
Well, it's like speculated, right?
Yes, it's, I mean, from my experience, it's purely speculated. The only reason why I kind of like glommed onto it is because the Keddie murders occurred in Northern California, not too far from where I grew up. So it was kind of like a local, not legend, but mm-hmm. like an urban kind of like this horrible murder happened here.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of you who don't know, the Keddie murders is an unsolved 1981 quadruple homicide in Keddie, California, which is like a really rural resort town in the Sierra Nevadas. So it's kind of, it's
a little out of the way.
It's very out of the way.
Yeah.
Well, in those mountains too, like it's hard to get there.
Yeah. So the murders took place in cabin 28 of the Keddie Resort during in April of 1981, or early the following, you know, early that morning of April 11th. So four people were murdered, and the children of those people were asleep in the next room. They were completely undisturbed. They didn't hear or see anything.
Ooh.
Yeah. They were in the house completely unharmed. And then the people involved were Lana Sue Sharp, her daughter Tina Louise Sharp, her son John Stephen Sharp, and John's friend Dana Hall Wingate.
Damn.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's like a lot of people. Just a list like that many people.
Yeah,
right?
So those
like,
are the people who were murdered. And then two younger sons, Rick and Greg, as well as their friend Justin, were also in the house. And those were the ones who were in the next room completely unharmed. Wow. Tina was missing
Oh, shoot.
And then she was missing until 1984, so 3 years later, when her skull and several of her bones were recovered at Camp 18 in California in Feather Falls in Butte County.
Damn.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, there was a lot of information on that. I was like, the script would be too long, but hey, yes, perfect.
I had to represent.
Because it is one of the theories. I know a lot of people talk about this movie, though. Yeah. Like, it had to be because of it was very similar in terms of like how.
Yeah, and there's a lot of mystery behind it because it remains completely unsolved to this day. There's a lot of questions around how did this person come in and kill four people and then not mm-hmm. wake up like three sleeping children in the next room? Why didn't they kill the three children sleeping in the next room? Like the children didn't see or hear anything.
Yeah.
And
weird.
Yeah. So there is some speculation that The Strangers was kind of loosely based on those mm-hmm. cabin murders.
Did anyone ask the director if that was the case?
He's coy. He's actually pretty coy about this
kind of
stuff.
Oh, is he just being a little winky about it?
He is.
Whatever.
He directly references the stuff that I was talking about, the Manson in particular.
Right.
Just because of his fascination with it. Of course, the one incident is childhood. But when people ask him about other stuff, he gets a little more like, well, maybe.
It could be.
Well, that's probably because it's not really based off anything. It's just allowing people to do whatever. But, I mean, that's what makes this so crazy, this movie so crazy, is that it could apply to all of these crazy things we've heard about, but then haven't been able to piece together.
Right.
And it, like, makes us as an audience want to put something together and make sense out of something that we don't understand.
Yeah, human brain is always trying
to these murders are crazy. Yeah.
Look for intention.
The way they affect their communities are really, really hard. And so.
And a community Webster here grew up in.
Ooh.
Yay, the murders.
Yeah. It's funny. The Keddie murders came up because I was going to write into my favorite murder about like my hometown murder, like way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And Kathleen knows what I'm talking about. But yeah,
Tom. Yeah, yeah.
She's like, oh, wait. I'm so. But yeah. So there's that, and then there's I'd like text my dad, and I was just like, "What's like the local murder?"
Yeah.
What the local murder?
Like the one everyone knows about. But anyway, we should get back to
the
actual like script.
Bertino actually didn't intend to direct The Strangers. He pretty much just took the money and let Universal take care of it. But of course, as we know, with all huge production studios, Universal didn't exactly have its shit together.
Uh-huh.
And so they had a hard time trying to find out who wanted to actually take on the film. And when I read that, Anthony, from your script, I was like, why? What does that say about Universal?
Can't
find a single director? Like, don't you have
so many
like vast resources available at your fingertips to find someone to do this?
Don't they have like that's just on so contract crazy. Where it's like, yeah, you have right. to direct what we tell you to direct.
Remember the a thing me and Alex talk about frequently on here is if you've worked with $1 million companies or big companies, they're still people and they suck sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes they just suck. They just throw money at the problem and it's like, ah, it's not working. More money.
Yeah, more money. Right. Surely well, solve then, this.
That explains their next two choices
yes.
for people that they asked to direct. So they asked Justin Lin, and I didn't know who that was until you said they put him back on the Fast and Furious duty real quick.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was like, yeah, why would they ask the Fast and Furious director to do a low-budget horror movie?
He had just
that
done
is
Tokyo
so
Drift.
Weird.
He literally did Tokyo Drift, and they're like, oh, Justin can do it.
No,
he can do a low-budget horror mm-hmm. movie.
Fresh off of one of, at the time, one of the most visually, like, whoa.
Like fucking candy bar looking, yeah.
Yeah. So
visually crazy. Candy bar looking. That is such a great way to put it.
It is.
All the Fast and the Furious movies are like that. It's just, like, explosion porn.
Mm-hmm.
With yeah,
blue, purple
kind
lights
of.
In the background. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just super testosterone heavy. Like
oh, so good, dude. I have such a soft spot for the Fast and the Furious
no,
movies. Like they're such garbage, but they're so fun.
I can't say I like them all, but the ones I like, I really like.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, some of them are just like boring, but like most of them, like I'm just like, this is a fun 2 hours of my life, like, just watching shit blow up.
I find myself not being able to look away sometimes. I'm like, shit, I'm sitting down. Okay, it's on.
That's so funny. I didn't get it until I actually saw one. And it, like, I think I saw the 7th one, like, I was super late into the franchise. So,
but
like,
who are these people?
Like, who, what was his name, died?
Paul
like
Walker.
The,
Paul
yeah, Walker it was dead. The one after yep. Paul Walker died. But it's crazy because they did a lot of the filming before he died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so he was actually, he was able to, like, be in the movie, yeah. But mm-hmm. he had already died, which was crazy. Mm-hmm.
No,
and then the parts that they did without him, they, like, just had his brother do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they put his face over it, and it looks so good. It, like, actually
have you seen
look creepy.
It recently?
No.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. Did okay. it
looks creepy.
Well?
It gives me some uncanny valley.
There's a couple scenes, but there's also some times where I feel like, I think at least during the action shots, when you don't have to really see his face.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. There's only so much that you don't jump cut a lot to.
Yeah.
Right. The only one where it really stands out is like at the very end when they're driving away. Like that is completely done. Like mm-hmm. with his brother. Totally.
You
just,
can
like,
tell.
His face is superimposed onto his brother's face, which is weird.
But it's just so sad. But you don't notice. You're just sad. You're just crying with the fact
true.
That he died.
I was like a little
so you're just not looking at it.
Yeah. It's like your tears like blurs it. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
I like it. That was what was so funny is like, I'm not a Fast and Furious fan. And I was sitting there being like, this is fucking sad. What the hell?
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, sorry. All right. Another distraction. Okay.
No,
so they
totally
were going
to
have that guy. They were going to have that guy. Fast and Furious guy do a horror movie for some weird ass reason. And he said no. And they put him back on Fast and Furious. And they were like, all right.
Mm-hmm.
And then they asked this other guy to do it. And he said, I'll do it for $40 million. And I thought that's so funny. Like, because like you said, like Universal got this from a screenplay contest. Like, why would they do that? And the more I thought about why you would do that kind of move, I was like, what a smart way out of not doing something,
right?
You know, like what a way to like pretty much tell your boss no, but do it in the best way possible. Be like, okay, I'll do it for $40 million. Like you read the script, you know it's not worth that.
I'm gonna start
get out of here,
right?
Be like, I'll do this like exuberant work task if you give me $1,000 right now in cash.
That's how I can complete my vision. It's a $40 million vision. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's the only way. It's the only way.
I can't do a good for less. I'm sorry, bosses. I can't. No.
There's just no way to do it.
Who's the other guy?
Oh, I forget. It was like some. He didn't do much.
Oh, okay. Wasn't like some. Okay.
I think he like had like a good first film, and he was like, "Yeah, I'll do it for $40 million. I'm hot shit right
and
now."
And then they were just like, "Fuck you."
No, dude. We didn't need you as much, actually. So yeah, go figure your shit out.
Yeah.
That's funny. So then they let 2 years pass. And eventually they decided to offer Bertino himself the chance to direct it, despite him not having directed anything before. I thought it was funny. He wrote this part. He read books on directing to get ready for the shoot.
Yes, I remember that from an interview from back in 2008.
So crazy.
He was talking about it. He's like, I actually had to read directing books.
And are there books my God. On how to direct?
I mean, yeah. There's plenty of books on how to direct, but like he actually had to go and like study to be like, oh, okay, shit.
Right.
That's what the person does.
It's the equivalent of someone being like, asking me, Alex Webster, like, do you want to direct this movie? And I said,
do you want to direct this millions of dollars production for Universal?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Okay, but here's the thing. Because like, I can write and I know how to format like, you know, like screenplays and shit, but like, if someone was just like, okay, you wrote this, now direct it, like, I wouldn't know how to start. Like, I would have no fucking clue.
That's scary.
I don't know how to direct at all.
It's a huge undertaking. I mean, I'm assuming when you put something together like this, you have some kind of creative vision in your mind of how it's going to look anyway.
Right.
So, I guess that's good. But overall, I just find that really, really funny.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, wow. All right, so despite the movie being made by Universal, essentially on a whim, the screenplay found its way to Liv Taylor on a trip from Japan to Los Angeles, and she absolutely loved it. Which, like, all right, go Liv Taylor. Or Tyler, sorry. Liv Tyler, sorry. I find it funny that she loved it. Like,
right?
I don't know.
She absolutely
That's
loved
cool.
it.
She did. She was very... I saw the interview, she was like, oh, I want to do this movie.
Interesting.
Like, when she got the script on that trip.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, who knows if that's true? Like, that's cool.
Could have been PR,
it is.
Too. Could have
been PR. Okay.
But somehow, like, it got... I don't know. I feel like you don't get a name like that on someone unless they actually want to do
that's
it.
That's true. That's a good point.
Especially her. It's so random of a person.
Right.
So, especially at that time, you know, because, like, as you say, like, she had her son, and so she wasn't really working very much at the time. And then all of a sudden, she comes out of doing Armageddon and, like, being associated with Aerosmith and Lord of the Rings. And now she's in this, like, low-budget horror movie. It's so random.
Yeah, she took some years off.
Well, that's fine. But she was in her dad's music videos.
Yeah.
Yes! That was the thing. Yeah, I found out she was in them when she was 16.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Right? All right. Oh, and I wrote that down because I was, like, kind of looking her up. I was like, what did she really do? Like, what got her? I know she's Steven Tyler's daughter, but, like, what really got her into this?
I mean, the weird
And then
thing
I saw that her first credits were, like, Aerosmith music videos. And I looked at the dates, and I was like, she must have been 16, though.
That is crazy.
Well, it's kind of funny, too. Like, in Armageddon, she has, like, a real intimate scene with Ben Affleck. Like, two Aerosmith in the background. I'm like, okay. You guys are leaning pretty hard on this.
I remember that. Because we were just talking about Armageddon, too.
Yeah.
But yeah, that scene, like, I remember, even as a teenager, I was able to, like, piece that together because I knew who Liv Tyler was. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I don't care for that shit at all.
Yeah, it's weird. I feel like for so long I disassociated her specifically from Aerosmith and Steven Tyler because that is such a weird moment. to remember her as this woman that had sex to her father's music. I don't know.
I can only hope that they didn't play it while they were filming the scene.
It's Michael Bay. You never know. It's Michael Bay.
I can only hope like that they and she went to and she had no idea. And then she went to go see it in theaters for the first time, and it was just like, what the fuck,
her
guys?
Friends are all ragging on her.
If group chats were a thing back then.
Back in 2000, whenever, yeah, that's right.
If group chats were a thing, I'm sure that...
There were a lot of good gifts.
I'm sure their Yahoo group IM was ablaze that day.
So that's crazy. So as we're obviously talking on, she was this huge star that was then added to this movie. So it allowed Universal to budget the movie at $9 million and then be shot between October of 2006 and early 2007. In other words, I thought it was so funny you wrote this. I was like, what? That's such a random thing. In other words, this film was shot between like when My Chemical Romance released their second studio album, The Black Parade, to when North Korea's first successful nuclear test happened.
That's right.
So, just a really weird way of encapsulating what happened in the early 2000s.
Thanks for putting it in a perspective that I understand.
Right? Doesn't that let you know, like, what we were dealing with at the time?
Oh,
you're like, yes,
gosh.
Yes, from The Black Parade being released to North Korea's first successful nuclear test, The Strangers was you know, was
my
shot.
My Chemical Romance that time, tickets are still tied up in Ticketmaster.
Are they?
Yeah, they're being held hostage because they rescheduled it. It's just, I was supposed to see them in October last year, but because of COVID, and so hopefully it got postponed to October of this year.
Okay.
So it's just
you'll get your chance. It'll happen,
day.
Alex. One day you're gonna see them. You're fine.
I'm not gonna know how to act.
I was never that big into My Chemical Romance. Like, I obviously they're big hits, like I liked, but overall, like, it's funny though. It's
nerd.
Well, they were a big part of that cultural moment.
They were.
So
they were
it really
huge.
Does speak to like how the punk angsty like thing like grew within that time.
I'm gonna
is
say
really how
almost
we
as
felt
huge as North Korea. Almost there. In terms of the national attention, there's My Chemical Romance just fucking up shit on the charts, and then North Korea like being like, "We can kill you now."
My Chemical Romance, Green Day, Fall Out Boy, like all that shit.
Yeah,
Rise Against was that part of it? Yeah,
was like
Rise
that,
Against
they
was...
were a little bit more on like the rock. Like this is more of like. I'm not going to say pop punk because that'll piss some people off who's listening. They're going to be like, no, this band is a pop punk, you freaking plant.
They had popular music, though. That's what makes anything pop. I find it so funny when people like want to shit on pop. It's like, well,
what do you
pop,
think it stands
all it means,
for?
All it means is popular. That doesn't mean anything about the music itself. Just that people liked it. Mm-hmm. All that it means.
They're like, no, so I'm the only one who can listen to this.
And this is how I'm justifying my Spotify favorites right now. It's popular, all right? Fuck you. I like listening to
popular music is good. There's a reason why a lot of people like it. It's not that bad.
Alex is so mad. I knew MCR would get you. I knew it.
Like, anytime you bring up My Chemical Romance, I, by law, have to start talking about them. You wrote in like side quests of like we're gonna talk about this.
I was trying
to
find ways to incorporate particular songs. I just couldn't. I'm a little too just beat up right now.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm not mad at you, Kathleen.
I appreciate that. Like that whole movement did have an influence on me as well. Like that's what was so crazy about that time.
Right.
Was that. It was almost like a phenomenon of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad you did put it in there that way. Because it really is, it exemplifies a lot about the times.
Oh, this is a nostalgia episode here. This is a nostalgia episode.
Yeah.
Anytime we do anything from, 2000 and probably about 2001 to, I want to say, 2012, like, it usually turns into, I'm back in my day.
Yeah. It does. It always does.
Well, because we're millennials, it's that time. It's been a long time for us now.
I know. It feels... even saying 2012, I was just like, oh, yes, that was 3 years ago.
No.
False.
It feels like, just a couple years ago, but it's so not.
No,
almost
it was
10.
So
almost
not.
Almost 10.
It was 9.
Almost 10. Yeah. My heart.
I'm sorry. And then this movie, let's get back to the script a little bit.
God.
Just like, sorry, I'm trying to get us back there.
Thank you.
So, Bertina based the home. We obviously discussed this, in the rural Texas homes he grew up around. Which, I think you're going to mention this later. Ugh, maybe I should just wait for that then. I have a good talking point for something that you're going to bring up later.
Oh, we'll have discussion.
Based around this. Yeah. Okay, so then Liv Tyler actually got tonsillitis during the film, as obviously she had to scream a lot. She would later then describe this as one of the most difficult filming experiences she's ever had. And she played Arwen in Lord of the Rings for all three movies. She also kicked the actress Laura Margulis, the girl that's like the the pinup girl looking one. Mm. She has like dark hair. Because it was the first day she had seen her in a mask and was legitimately terrified. Yeah. So that is so crazy to me, but that's like that makes funny. So much sense.
Yeah, I believe Laura Margulis was like, she made a point to be like not associating with Liv Tyler at all prior to their first scene together to really scare to get the reaction. But it was so scary. Liv Tyler like actually fucked her up a little bit.
That's so crazy.
Because they are fucking terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
And then the original ending of The Strangers, the killers actually had their faces revealed, hence the name The Faces. That Anthony brought up earlier.
Stupid.
So it's stupid. But it's great because then after, you know, as we can obviously say, and then with some similar test screenings, they decided to keep their identities mystery. But then I was looking up the actors that played those people, and like, I think this movie was so critically panned that they literally weren't able to get anything else in like Hollywood after that. Like, this is all their main title.
That is for a lot of the people involved, not named Liv Tyler or the other guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the shortest cast, by the way, ever, I think, we've ever had.
Two names? I think that is.
I think that might be the shortest
two names
for their cast list that we've ever had, yeah.
Damn.
It's so crazy. Well, and it's sad because there are three other people in it, but they don't even get named. Because you just never see their face. You never see their face. And you don't want to because they are horrible people. Okay. And then, no, what were we going to say?
I got it, Alex.
Thanks.
That's the name of our podcast. Yay.
All right. So then, so then the test audiences had their say. So now it was time for the critics.
Oh, this is an interesting one.
Okay. So
Let's do it, Alex. What is it? What'd they say?
I can read. critics absolutely did not like The Strangers. This bitch has a 28% on Rotten Tomatoes, which isn't easy to do.
No, I think that particular number, it's not easy to have that many bad reviews, really.
Well, yeah, and it's that, and then, people really have to not like it.
Mm-hmm.
Our boy Roger Ebert really did not like this movie, awarding it the elusive 1.5-star rating, saying, quote, "My mistake was to read the interview with the director," unquote. Ebert goes on to praise Bertina's ability as a director despite wanting to give the film 1 star. He was a bit lenient knowing Bertino's backstory. He concluded his review saying The Strangers, quote, "does what it sets out to do. I'm not sure that it earns the right to do it."
Yeah. His whole review is digging in on the production of this movie.
Like the production. Yeah.
Like it being a first-time director and all that stuff. So he's in there like, I can see this is really amateur, but there's something there. But I hate it. That's the gist of his review. It's amateur, there's something there, also it sucks.
But also, that really speaks to the times that it came out in, because I feel like this is really before movies now. Like, if this came out now, I'm not sure if it would have the same type of pan in that way. Like, I think that's almost an elitist way of looking at it. And I think everybody knew that about him, which is what was great about him before, but not so much now.
I don't know if I agree with that.
What?
Like, I think if this movie came out now,
mm-hmm.
I think it would be even worsely shit on.
You think so?
I think so.
Well, but I'm saying not specifically for it being amateur.
Yes, okay, not for being amateur.
That's true, that's a good point. Okay, that's a good point.
That I do agree
with. Yes. And that's this guy's point mm-hmm. here, essentially.
Okay, yes. Okay, yeah, that
now,
I do agree with.
Now that wouldn't be as so much, yeah, exactly.
I think this movie would be profoundly shit on if it came out today. I don't think it would be shit on necessarily for the directing style, because I think it was fine. Like, there wasn't any particular moment.
Yeah, that actually was okay.
Yeah, I think, there was nothing about, the directing that I was just like, what is going on? Like,
nothing stood out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it was it was forgettable in the sense that, like, it was neither positive nor negative.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah.
There's that. But yeah, there's all the other things that I did not like about this movie.
Oh, we'll get into it. We're almost there, Alex. We're almost there. You're going to get to talk about it soon.
Okay. Sorry. I'll hold it together. So Stephen Hunter of The Washington Post says the film was, quote, "a fraud from start to finish," unquote.
Damn.
Jesus, that's rough. A fraud?
Yeah. Oh, I put The Washington Post twice. I think New York Times is no.
Okay.
With some other publication.
Okay. Wesley Morris of the Washington Post or the New York Times.
No, It was U.S. Weekly.
Okay, of U.S. Weekly was especially critical of the first-time director, saying, quote, Bertino has the pretensions of an artist and the indelicacy of a hack. He tries to get under our skin with a pile driver, unquote.
Damn.
Jesus Christ, guys.
I think all of these people were just so mad that he was an amateur.
I kind of get that vibe in some of these reviews when I was reading them. I'm like, oh, you're mad because your screenplay didn't get picked up by a university piece of shit. I hear a couple of them had that vibe.
Yeah.
Pause for plane. That isn't me.
Oh, there's a plane in your background.
That's her.
Oh, sorry.
No.
Oh, that's okay.
It happens.
You can't do anything. It's a plane. This happens to us all the time.
Yeah. There's literally nothing I can't even hear it.
It's funny because I can't hear it because I have headphones on, but you guys can because my microphone is out. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I live right next to like a municipal airport, so I get like biplanes all the time.
And see, when we would record at my place, we would get car accidents. And
sirens. You know, we got sirens all the time.
Sirens, screaming homeless people.
I mean,
I'm surprised you didn't get any secret ghosts on any of those recordings.
We did.
Yeah.
No. I swear to God, like, I'm not even joking. I've sent this to people.
Oh, I remember.
I sent it to you. Like, what?
That was creepy.
Yeah, so.
What?
There was an episode forever ago where we were recording and I'm talking and then, or Anthony's talking. It was specifically Anthony. And there's a male voice. And it was actually in my apartment. It wasn't yours. It was just us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was so freaked out. But you can hear someone, like, whisper something.
Oh, right.
And it wasn't...
There was no reason for anybody to be able to whisper that clearly.
Yeah, there was, like, a very clear, distinct whisper.
What'd they say? What was the whisper?
I don't know. It was just, like, a very quick, like... Psh. Like, it was, like, it was some, like, it was another voice. It wasn't something, like, rubbing against the microphone. It was, like, a distinct...
It's a distinct human voice.
It was a voice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and I recorded it, and I sent it to people, and I was... Because I had to cut it from the episode. Well, actually, no.
Because you were terrified of it?
No. I kept it in because I wanted to see if anyone else was going to notice it, but I think because, like, unless you're listening to it with, like, my editing headphones, I don't think you would, like, really, really hear it.
And you're specifically looking for things, too, like that.
But it was really freaky.
That was scary.
I sent it to everyone, and I was just like, do you hear something here?
I didn't hear it at first, either, I remember. I was like, no, what's going on? Why? And then it hit, and I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah. It was freaky. Anyway, my apartment's probably haunted, but that's okay.
You have a poltergeist.
Everyone's house is on top of someone's grave at this point.
Or some graveyard somewhere.
Yeah.
So, the New York Times and the Hollywood Reporter, going back to the movie, praised the film, but the bad far outweighed the good when it came to the critics. With audiences, it was the exact opposite for some time. The Strangers was delayed and delayed and delayed. it was supposed to release in July of 2007, and it eventually became November of 2007. A full month after the release of The Black Parade, Alex. Thanks, Anthony.
Just so you know, a full month after, you were jamming, you knew your jams at that point.
I was just like,
you're like, mama, we all go to hell. Teenagers scared the living shit out of me. All the tracks.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Because I actually remember seeing this, like, in theaters, like, getting out of school and watching this. I was probably...
Jesus Christ.
Sophomore, junior. Yeah.
Oh, my God. July of 2007. I was going into seventh grade.
Damn.
Okay.
Yeah, I was... I.
Listen, I'm not going to say where I was at. Let's go. Let's keep going.
I was just like, wow, a child. In November of 2007, I was in seventh grade. Then after that, in November 2007, and a month after the release of The Black Parade, it was delegated to sometime in the summer of 2008. Eventually, they did decide on May, even though that's not even close to summer, but that's fine.
Close enough.
I mean, sure, it was spring. Hold on one second.
They just wanted to get it out of the way.
So clearly, there was not faith in The Strangers, but whoever was in charge of the distribution clearly wasn't aware of how popular horror was in the Saw era.
Very true.
The Strangers more than doubled its budget in its first weekend alone, opening at $21 million. Yeah. And it remained a big hit, becoming what is known as a sleeper hit, and netting around $82.4 million worldwide when all is said and done.
That's big.
Yeah, especially for this fucking movie.
Yeah.
I can think of so many more movies that deserved this.
$82 million?
Yeah. I like that this has, and we see this in a lot of other horror films, where it does, okay, like, it opens well, but then, like, people tell their friends, they're like, yes, oh my fucking god, I saw this movie,
you scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, you like, you need to go, it's super freaky, and that's how you get your sleeper hit type numbers.
I remember this having good word of mouth.
Where it snowballs.
Yeah, it totally did.
It did. Yeah, I mean, I remember, I also, I recall.
Yeah, I was told to go during the day, and I'm so glad I did.
Oh my gosh.
I was scared to shit. I really was.
I remember being told that as a kid, where it's just like going to see scary movies during the day because it made it less scary for some reason.
It does. When you walk out in the day at night in the day, you're like, okay, like I have time to emotionally prepare for the night.
Oh, that's true. Walking out at night when you're legit terrified by a movie, that could be a hard walk to plot.
So for me, I like one of my favorite. I mean, I didn't watch scary movies. I didn't go and see horror films a lot growing up. As I've mentioned about 40 million times on this podcast,
we know your story.
But yeah, one of my favorite feelings is going in during the day, walking out at night for a movie.
Yeah,
like going,
that's true.
Like going in like an hour before sunset and then coming out, the sun is like completely gone, and it's just like, I've time traveled.
Don't you miss doing that back when the city was open? We'd get drinks after that and talk about the movie.
Yeah.
This year.
No.
It's going to happen.
Get our shots.
Fully vaccinated.
No. Man, I miss that. Good old Hollywood.
She's just like, no. Oh, man. Okay. Oh. What? That reminds me. ArcLight is owned in LA by Scientologists.
No.
We can't go back.
Why did you tell me that? I love the ArcLight.
I know, but I needed to tell you.
Oh.
Because wait, what?
Why? One of our favorite
theaters.
How
do you know?
Because
no, I know the ArcLight. Yeah, I know that. It's a really nice theater.
I don't know if like all ArcLights are owned by Scientologists, but the one in Hollywood is owned by the Scientologists of Los Angeles.
No.
Not the one in the one that's out east?
I'm not sure. I'd look into it, but the one in LA, I know for sure.
The iconic one.
I was reading about it on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It's owned by Scientologists.
Oh.
Sorry.
It's unfortunate.
I was also just listening to a podcast about Shelley Miscavige, so I'm like really mad at Scientologists right now.
Oh, is that the Last Podcast Network one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was supposed to listen to that one
too. It's really good.
Yeah, look at us. We're breaking my heart here, Alex.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Anyway. So, fans really liked it. Like, might even say they fucking loved it. And for a good look on what we have. Oh, yeah, we have Letterboxd. on good old Letterboxd, The Strangers has a 3.1 out of 5 rating out of 4,100 reviews. So not a whole lot, but quite a few. I mean, I'd say that's pretty middle of the road.
Yeah.
The reviews are pretty divisive. Okay, let's dive into this. Austin Gorski says in his 4-star review, quote, "The Strangers at times only barely resembles what you call an actual movie. There are no character arcs, no plot, no motives to speak of. It almost feels like a documentary at times without actually having that documentary look to it," unquote. That is gnarly.
Interesting. I mean, makes sense, though. I can buy it, yeah. There's not really arcs. Yeah. There's not, like, arcs.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No. That's true. There isn't. There's no development of any, individual kind of thing.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. Conversely, Diamond Bolt awards the film 2 stars, saying, "Ooh, so spooky. He wears scary mask. Ooh, loud jump scare noise. Ooh, wow, so scared." Unquote.
I wanted you to read that. That's why I gave you the section.
That was good.
Let's see. She nailed it. You did good.
I was gonna say,
that was a good read.
5-star read right there.
Yeah. That was great.
Someone does this.
I was like,
day.
I'm so glad I'm not doing that. I don't know what to do.
And that is the plot of The Strangers. Thank you. Thank you for being a guest, Kathleen.
That's crazy. Oh, geez. Sarah, having not read any of the production interviews, gives this film 2 stars, simply stating, quote, I would have simply pretended I was not home, unquote.
Yeah.
I And finally, Aaron gives the
especially phone. When they say it's 4 a.m. You're like, no.
Dude, I know. I fucking know. We're going to get into it.
I didn't get to that point. Like, yeah.
I'm sure we're going to talk about it, but, like, I know.
Yeah.
And finally, Aaron gives the film 3.5 stars, saying, quote, for my birthday, I decided to give myself anxiety, unquote.
Yeah. I love Letterboxd.
It's very
it's
funny.
So good. It's so good. But let's, okay, so now that that's wrapped up, this actually does have kind of a legacy to it. A weird one that's mm-hmm. highly academic. So this is why this... I would like us to keep breaking in if you guys want to talk about the points these guys are making, because, yeah.
Yeah.
I would like to talk about some of these points, because I actually see them, so.
And I know one of Alex's favorite things is in this.
I know, I see the word scholar, so I'm just, I see, and the words film scholar, so I'm just like, oh my gosh, did you write an Alex's Theory Corner without me?
Not necessarily, but you'll find out right now. So fan reaction, critical reception, box office.
Post 9/11 horror.
That's right, see, right there, you knew it, yep. Mm-hmm. But I mean, with all the things we talked about, the whole picture of the strangers is actually kind of confusing. So here to add to that whole confusion is its academic accolades, as this movie weirdly has touched a pretty big amount of scholars in terms of just, like, having it explored. Yeah.
There's so many better home invasion films, but we'll get into it. Jesus, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, this movie got a sequel about 3 years ago, and it was about as good as you would expect, and it was stuck in a development hell. So that's all we're going to touch on, the Strangers sequel. Yeah. And unfortunately, it seemed like Brian Bertino hadn't seen the success warranted to a box office draw, only doing low-budget films that almost never saw release outside of VOD or the festival circuit. Poor bastard.
Poor bastard.
Still, his debut proved to be...
Maybe that's where he wants to be, guys. Maybe that's where he
that's
likes
true.
It.
That's true. Like, fuck the system.
Not everybody has to be a big, you know...
Right, but if you start there...
To enjoy themselves.
But if you start there, I don't know.
Maybe you hate it. Maybe you hate it the whole time.
You know
that's
what?
True.
Maybe this is not the movie he really wanted to make. Maybe this was a bunch of compromises that he had to make with people.
Let's get Brian Bertino. Let's get him.
He wrote and directed it. I like that you're, like, defending him, and I'm just like, fuck this guy.
No, I just always try to take that stance, because it's just like, maybe he's happy.
I know.
You don't have to shit on him.
He might be happy, though. That's true.
That is such an optimistic look, and I appreciate that so much, considering that we've been doing this for almost 3 years, and I think I'm just getting more...
No, you're getting a little jaded on it.
More jaded. Every episode, every week, a little piece of my soul dies.
When we explore how Hollywood shoots out these directors?
A little piece of my soul dies, but it is then reborn as, like, a horror-loving, like, just, like, monster. But just very jaded about Hollywood.
So, yeah.
This genre in particular will do that to you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Within film.
But this movie proved to be a major anomaly for those who study film. So for this section, we're going to break down a few of the themes that these scholars have latched onto, directly.
I'm so excited.
Film scholar Tony Williams has perhaps the most obvious takes, attributing the 70s-era style home as a reflection of the, quote, American tradition of violence that is random and without any coherent explanation. Williams sees the killers as representations of the couple's unresolved tensions.
Do you want to talk about this now?
Talk about it. Go for it. Alex.
Okay.
What do you think?
Alex, what do you got? So with this particular take, I can kind of see it because, like, the cabin has that kind of, like, 70s look to it already.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they purposely went to some place that technologically is kind of, like, taken a few steps backwards. Like,
yeah.
They're playing, like, vinyls and, you know what I mean?
There's an aesthetic to that.
It's an older house.
Mm-hmm.
It's his dad's cabin or whatever. I like that this makes some rhyme or reason out of this, what I at the time found very stupid, failed proposal subplot.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I was just like, I could have watched this whole movie without that and would have been none the wiser. I would have been fine.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. I kind of forgot about it after a while.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's like they show up and, like, it could have been them as fucking depressed and fucked up as they were, or it could have been them, like, being like, woo, we're happy, mm-hmm. woo, we're in the blah, 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 blah.
That plays to the randomness thing he's talking about right here.
But I'm saying they could have shown up like that, and it like I would have been emotionally impacted exactly the same. I didn't give a shit.
Well, right, because there's no character development of any kind. So that's the point. Yeah, is that you're not able to. It doesn't matter what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's just like the act of trying to humanize them is all that it, humanize them as like victims was very clear, but. Cared about them particularly, so the only thing they could really do was like, oh, let's create tension between them so that there's always tension in the film. It seemed like a very obvious like way to try to introduce these characters as victims and get them the audience to empathize with them without actually having to create a character,
right? Without having to put the work in to create the character.
Exactly.
You're creating a scenario in which gets empathy or trying to
but
get empathy.
What it also does, sorry,
no, it's okay.
I was just gonna say, just to argue the other side, is what it also does is it makes them such a blank canvas that anybody in the audience can feel like they are them. Think about you're someone who's not typically a horror movie watcher. You know, like, you're able to just kind of see them as people, and then, like, all of a sudden this crazy shit happens.
That's a good... Yeah.
And you're, like, thinking about yourself, like, what would you do then if this person tried, like, came into your home and tried to do this or tried to do that? Like,
again,
this came across to me more as, like, a true crime documentary reenactment thing.
Yeah.
So,
well, but that's the thing, though, is, like, I think that the character development, if you even want to call it that, was kind of just, like, it was paced strangely because if they had introduced this, like, failed... The movie is, like, what, an hour and a half? Like a
Yeah, it's a clean 90.
It's a clean
it's
90.
Really
it's really
short.
Quick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like they could have spent 15 minutes, if that, 10 minutes even, because 10 minutes is a long time in a fucking movie, setting up, like, them being a couple, going to this wedding, but, like making me know who they are as people as opposed to just, like, them walking in and being like, okay, they're clearly pissed off with each other, or they just hate each other because, like, that first scene where they're driving, I don't know that there was, like, some failed engagement. I could just think that they're, like, a really cold couple who hate each other. Like, the way it sets it up, it just, like, they introduce this, like, really emotional conflict way too soon, in my opinion.
Well, because it tries to be artsy with it. It's trying to keep with, like, you just see this big disclaimer, right? And these people just died, right? And so the next scene has to be, like, which is just funny about how this movie frames itself.
Yeah.
Like, you could have just started with them at the wedding.
Agreed.
And then, like and gone through that.
Yeah.
If just were chronological in your order from the very beginning, you would have had a much bigger impact.
One more director book, he would have got it.
We
would have had a better paced movie.
I mean, he read, like...
He was trying to set the tone as though it was a horror movie in the beginning, which is just what all beginner people want to do.
He read David Lynch's book on, like, chronological...
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
Because it's jumping back and forth, and then I'm just like, what is going on? And then he read, like, the first two chapters, and then he was just like, okay, I'm done.
I know, right? Okay, so that all came from Tony Williams' one sentence. Let's find another scholar here. So... scholar Philip Simon sees the film as a commentary on the divide between the underprivileged and the privileged classes in American society. In particular, he notes that the film, quote, undermines the conventional notion of rural society as a simpler, crime-free place. He may or may not have actually read the production notes. How did that take? So, yeah. What do you guys think? Do you think that's a stretch?
Yes.
Isn't it a little bit of a stretch?
Well, because I don't think people think rural society is a simpler, crime-free place. Like, I know so many places, especially someone who came from, like, a pseudo-rural community growing up, like, for, like, a good chunk of my life. It was, like, simple, yes, but it was also filled with drugs. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Every time I visit my hometown, I'm just, like... There are so many people actively doing drugs on the street right now, and people are just cool with it.
I mean, that's now my take on this. I'm gonna go back to 2008.
Okay,
around the time this was really early 2000s. I remember I was a kid on forums all the time, and I would go on these gaming forums, but they had a off-topic section. That I would go to and see what you'd talk to a bunch of people from different states.
Areas and stuff.
Yeah, different all around the U.S. And I remember...
AIM!
Right? But a big thing with people when they would start talking shit on other states is a lot of rural people would say, like, crime-ridden cities and this and that. And they would present themselves as a safer alternative.
It's so funny.
Consistently. It was a consistent narrative back in the day.
Interesting.
Yeah. There is a narrative. Around this there used to be a narrative. That countryside was safe.
Nowadays, I feel like we have more information.
Yeah.
And that's generally, you know, we understand that that's not always the case, and there's a lot of stuff that goes down, a lot of repressed stuff, too. But back then, like, early internet, just had that, like, you couldn't investigate so much.
Assumption.
Back then. Yeah, they just had that assumption going into it. From my experience, though.
I'd agree. Especially, I mean, just to kind of dovetail this into the next point that you're going to get. Oh, maybe I'll wait then. I want to talk about the 9/11 point.
Oh, that's going to be a fun one.
The 9/11 point. Yeah, okay. We'll get there. Sorry. I was just going to jump the gun.
Yeah, it's going to... Alex,
No, do it. Let's do it now. Fuck it. Let's go. Okay. Unless you have more to say about the rural America.
I just don't know if
I agree with that point, but, like, I kind of see the point that they're trying to make. Also, I don't remember a whole lot about society at large in 2008 because I was very focused on...
You were tiny.
I was very focused on myself as a person. Like, I was just like, who am I? Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. Like, listening to My Chemical Romance.
I know, right? That's funny. Okay, so, but...
sweet.
Alas, Kevin Wetmore closely ties the strangers to post 9/11 violence. In particular, the random act of it being as close to a representation of its time as slashers of the 80s were. So, on this, he says that death is a random act in post 9/11 horror, the result of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, as the cliche goes. Unlike an 80s slasher horror, for example, where engaging in negative behavior such as drinking, doing drugs, having premarital sex are often forerunners to being killed
by the killers. There's a rationale behind it, yeah.
Death is random and unrelated to one's behavior in this particular film. So, how do you guys feel about that take?
Kathleen, I'll let you go first because I have a lot to say.
She does.
I mean, I feel like my first point when I first read this was like, why does everyone try to make everything about 9/11?
I'll tell you.
That was my initial thing.
Okay.
But then I did kind of, but I don't think it's so much about 9/11, but then just at the time in general, which was like coming out of the 90s, in the early 2000s, serial killers, I think we're at an all-time high. Our understanding and awareness of serial killers, just that anybody could be a serial killer, like that was a strong narrative at the time. It heightened our awareness of just all types of horror, 9/11, sure, but that's such a generalized thing to say that it applies to this. It feels like a stretch.
So in the context of this movie, you're waiting. Wait on this particular...
Do you have anything you'd like to...
No, I want to hear your take. I'm waiting right now.
So, okay, quick crash course.
I knew it.
So, for those of you who haven't listened to our previous, like, early 2000s episodes, we almost always find a way to shoehorn in 9/11 because 9/11 was, like, this big macro event that changed America. And, like, it was, like, a cultural reset in, like, not a great way. It really, really, you see that a lot in films. There was this shift of your campy teen films. A big, great example of this, even though it's Canadian, is Ginger Snaps.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And then, you know, a couple of years later, you know, we're getting films like Saw. And that jump is very often accredited to 9/11 because we kind of, as an American culture, kind of reapproached how we viewed violence and what, because it was, you know, however you want to interpret it, a countrywide trauma or whatever. I am always very fascinated by this, this kind of thing. I was very young when 9/11 happened, so I don't remember a pre-9/11 society. And
I totally remember.
I bet you do, and that's why I love talking to you about it, because you can kind of see that cultural shift. I can only read about it. I was very young. I was six. I was 5 or 6 when 9/11 happened. I was 6. And then I don't remember, like, life before or life after. I just remember life.
You're like, this has always been the default, right? Yeah.
No, it wasn't.
I would say on that, I mean, it's when you look at entertainment between the events, essentially, even just looking back retrospectively, you look at, like, how cheesy and how campy stuff was kind of like available and like kind of normal, and like it was kind of like I don't know, a staple of programming in the 90s, definitely 80s, but like all that. But then again, after the big American trauma, we didn't see camp for a long time. It was mostly cynical. Like, I feel like media got a lot more...
It got darker.
Yeah, definitely.
And
more grounded.
Yes.
Much more grounded.
Yes.
Which is something that wasn't always the case in film and TV prior.
Yeah, there was a... there's also this theory when it comes to horror films that they reflect our anxieties as a society.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's going on at the time. So in your 50s and 60s,
yeah,
you have a lot of alien invasion films. Then that's a lot to do with like the Cold War and Russian, you know, invasion and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then in you know we are just that's the prime example, but you can kind of look at it, at the line of what's popular, what's in vogue, and Jordan Peele's really great at that, of taking what is popular and in vogue and turning it into like, no, this is what it's trying to actually say.
Yeah.
Case in point, Get Out.
And his next one, Us, too.
Yeah, Us is also really good. But yeah, so I do agree to an extent with what Mr. Wetmore is saying.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me because it's like it's a very interesting combination of your home invasion films, which relies on a very particular anxiety that most people have.
Yeah,
you know, like everyone is kind of at one point or another been sitting in your apartment and been like, what if someone is standing in my room right now waiting to kill me? Like, I don't know if it's just me. I feel like I'm speaking for a lot of people when I say that, but it could just be like people with generalized anxiety like me, but...
No, during the holidays when all my roommates are out and I'm the only one there and that dark-ass apartment not turning on a hall light or anything, I'm like, oh, this is creepy.
Yeah.
Like, if anything happened to me right now, nobody know.
Your place now?
Yeah, when everybody's gone, when it's just me at the apartment, which doesn't happen a lot, but when it is, it freaks me the fuck out a little bit.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, that place is horrifying. I completely understand why.
Yeah, Anthony loves his place, but every time I'm there, I'm just like, I will get murdered.
Get me out.
but also...
I don't know. Your place is horrifying, dude. Props to you for living there, but wow.
Oh, it's wonderful.
All right, weirdo.
Lots of white people, too. It's safe, very safe.
Ew, weirdo.
But also, I think in terms of the relating to how this is reflective of post-9/11 horror, cynical and grounded.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two things I think this movie is very emblematic of. That's kind of its thing. Very grounded and not a lot of optimism. Just not.
Yeah. Okay, so I was super high when I watched this movie. I had this thought, and I'm really glad I remember it, because I did make a point to, like, bookmark it for later as I was having this thought, and I'm like, I can't forget it. I need to sit here and concentrate on it so I don't. there's a lot of scenes in this movie where, like, as the viewer, we can see the strangers, and... Liv Tyler, whoever, whatever the other guy, he can't. Like, our couple can't. And that we see it in the beginning when, like, he's standing there and, like, that really iconic scene where, like, she's looking forward, just like, this is weird, and he's just standing there watching her.
Silently.
Like, just creepy.
Yeah.
Or, like, the scene when she's, like, crawling through the front lawn and, like, one of the girls is, like, following behind her.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are to say, like, I could kill you, but I am actively choosing not to currently at this moment.
It
was very interesting for me to watch that as a viewer, and it got me thinking about, like, us as viewers watching horror movies, and, like, we're kind of doing the same thing in, like, its weird fucked up way.
Like a weird voyeuristic kind of thing.
Yeah, it was a weird voyeurism thing, and it was, like, those shots were made for us.
Yeah.
Specifically, as viewers.
Right.
And because nothing...
That's a really, like, good point.
Yeah, and nothing ended up happening to, you know, the couple, because, like, we would just see them, and it would make us anxious, and then they would be gone, and it's just like, okay, what was the fucking point?
The implied thing that something happened in that moment, and then they are then made aware too that someone was able to watch them and do that.
Right.
So that's that is, like, they do somehow find out as people that there are people without seeing them.
Yeah, it got me thinking about watching and voyeurism, and, like, it was... Laura Mulvey would be proud.
Bring it back to college.
But, yeah, and I do like the connection it made where, like, the death in post-9/11 horror films are kind of, not pointless, but, I mean, they do use the word pointless in the quote, but it's random. It's random.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like, it's whoever it kind of happens to be, wrong place, wrong time. Mm-hmm. Versus,
but, like, motive is absent a lot of times.
Yes.
Yes.
Versus the 80s, which, again, very, you know, pure, you know, purity culture.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Which it still has threads follow through to today, mm-hmm. Just in a lot more subtle ways than, like, the sex equals death trope from the 80s that I know and love and, you know, not cherish, but, like, good it's old, fun to talk about.
Good old Jason Voorhees protecting American Christian ideals. Yep.
Protecting young women's virginities one mm-hmm. murder at a time.
So, to wrap up on just the production stuff, although The Strangers has seen success and derision in the academic and even fan circles, it's oddly found its old niche in the genre and can now be considered a cult classic. Its sequel, on the other hand, opened up against Marvel's Black Panther and probably fell off the map of relevancy when it comes to modern horror.
Yeah, so, I definitely went to go see Black Panther that weekend.
Instead of The Strangers. Yeah, definitely.
So there is a second one.
Yeah.
There is a second one. Okay.
So
I didn't watch it.
I mean, with that, this Strange movie's wrapped up. Overall, what do you guys think of the movie? Like, what are your thoughts on The Strangers? Kathleen, you are a guest. You get it first.
Please take
you
it.
Get it
okay,
first.
I was just going to say, I really do have to say, like, when I first saw this movie, I was probably 14, 15, and it legitimately terrified me. And it made me think about just, like, I don't know if I was just as a kid, like, a particularly weird person for always thinking about serial killers and home invasions, and, like, I was constantly worried that, like, something like that would happen. And so seeing this movie, it was just like, I don't know, it just hit home for me, because, like, the thought as well is, like, sometimes you want to leave the city to be alone, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, that's kind of, like, the idea here is that they're out in the city, like, that's the idea of a vacation home. It's like, you do that only sometimes, but, and then that time is then taken away from you. It's just, like, that is a powerful motif that I thought that person who brought up earlier, like, the more I thought about things later, the more I kind of appreciated it. But then also, like, the second time I watched it, I was just like, oh, this is not as good as I remember it. So, like, I don't know how to deal with, like, the fact that, like, when I was a kid, I just was really impacted by it, more so than, like, I would think back at that movie time to time when I was thinking about, like, why am I so obsessed with serial killers, like, that type of stuff. This movie just kind of hit a weird... I think it's because it really doesn't indulge in the blood that much that it had a more impact on me. Because I don't really respond well to movies having a lot of gore. It doesn't... Like, I turn myself off from it because I find it so gross.
Okay.
So it's not then scary to me anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. So this movie was... Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go for it.
Oh, no.
Because you have to imagine it a lot more. Although all that tension and all that anxiety in mm-hmm. the beginning, it, like, as you said earlier, was towards the audience. And so you do... I feel like effective as a movie in that way.
Yeah, without playing too much into the gore hand. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also just want to say, I started watching, like, true crime television.
That's the thing I was also going to say. Yeah,
from the, sorry, well, please, like, yes. Because you had mentioned it on your thoughts and, like, kind of, like, your relationship with true crime and how this movie kind of connects to it. I was not allowed to watch horror films growing up until mm-hmm. until I moved out, basically. But I was allowed to watch as much true crime TV as I could stand. Mm-hmm. Go figure. So I grew up...
That shit's real. Right. I learned from that shit.
I grew up on a very healthy diet of true crime television.
Mm-hmm.
So I also was terrified of, like, I remember, like, I want to say the first 2 months that I lived by myself, I was convinced, like, I was going to get, like, murdered psycho style in the shower.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like, someone's gonna break in, someone's gonna find out, like, they're gonna learn how I'm what time I shower or something, and just
still
break
to
in.
This day
yeah
still to this day, if I'm home alone and showering, I keep my door open so I can hear things better.
Okay, I always do that because I live alone, but, like, that's the thing is that I'm always showering alone, so... So it's a double-edged sword with that one, but, I do resonate with that a lot, and I think this movie kind of also appealed to that because a lot of the promotional materials were, like, kind of, like, based on a true story, which I did also want to talk about. This is kind of also tied into this era of horror films that are all based on a true story.
Yeah, they had to have some real
Because for some reason makes it scarier. Because,
it sells tickets, Alex. It sells tickets.
It's the Blair Witch thing.
$82 million.
It's the Blair Witch treatment. By saying it's based off of a true story, or it is a true story, people are like, oh, I'm interested.
Yeah, and then also this is early enough in 100%. The internet, too. Viral marketing was a thing. Yeah. So it makes discussion happen because people are speculating. Mm-hmm. And it drives them to the theater to see it.
And that's how they were able to make it a cult hit, or a sleeper hit, because like everyone was able to hop onto their Motorola Razors.
Yeah. Or Blackberry. Some of us have Blackberries.
Whatever.
Yeah. Well, and it's the true crime thing, back to that, too. This does play more to me like a bad reenactment of a true crime documentary versus an actual movie. So that's what's so funny. That's why you get that like critic slam, because it does, because it
have
is
that.
You can tell that it's amateur, and you can tell that there's like, it doesn't know exactly how to scare you at certain moments or ride the tension that it's using, right? Or like, you know, it could have made a lot of choices a lot better by trying to specifically not be artsy. And
I love that you mentioned
true crime documentaries.
Yes. There's that. Oh my gosh, I had it and now it's gone.
I could see you struggling right now. What is it?
Oh man. I was holding on to it and I was just like, you have to say this or else you're gonna die. And then it
gone. No.
I'm gonna die. It's fine. Continue.
It's gonna happen eventually. So
it'll come back to you.
I think
We'll sit there. It'll come back.
Okay. In the middle of any discussion, just pop up with it. Uh-huh. Just go.
Yeah.
But I mean, I agree with you guys. I think there was something very amateur about it. However, it's also oddly polished too in certain ways. Like it's a good looking movie. Like it's a very good looking movie.
Production value for sure.
Effective actors that know what they're doing, and even even the villains themselves can be portray menacing very well. It's just. Yeah. It's kind of, what's the word? It's light.
Yeah.
It's light on substance in a lot of ways, which I think, you know, it's a big part of Ebert's criticism, which actually kind of reigns true.
I remembered my point.
Oh, what is it?
I love that you mentioned that there wasn't a lot of blood in this because I watched the unrated version.
Oh!
It is significantly bloodier.
Is it?
I'm so glad you mentioned that because I literally last night specifically chose not to do the unrated because I was like, I want to see what I saw as a kid, right?
I watched
but
the
then
unrated
I
version.
I saw there was an unrated one. I was like, oh, they're going to talk about that one, though. I bet there's a lot more blood. I literally thought that.
Basically, I'm assuming because, like, so when the friend gets shot in the head, if they don't show you his head, I'm assuming you didn't see the unrated version because they show you his head getting blown off in graphic detail. And I was just like, wow, this is really gruesome. And then I forgot I was watching the unrated version. I'm like, this made it to theaters? And I was like, oh,
it's funny you say that because like when I watched it this time, I was like, I remember that moment being a lot gorier and being way more impacted by that moment than the one I saw.
You might have actually seen the unrated version originally.
I don't know how. It was in theaters.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't have. You were 15.
But I mean, like, that was a big impact in the movie. If you saw it that early, I've seen movies later on, I'm like, oh, that was way different, wasn't it?
That
and
was
realistically, like, no.
Like,
in my mind, it was.
I figured my memory was, just a lot, worse, obviously.
Yeah.
But
yeah, the unrated version it's a lot bloodier and they linger on like a lot of more like gore shots. Also, I mean at the end when they're getting stabbed, I don't know if that's like way more detailed than like what you guys saw because I've only ever seen this movie once and it was the unrated version. But it's only like a couple minutes longer. It's like 2 minutes longer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like 3 or I want to say like 2 to 4 minutes.
Yeah. I think I saw the R one. Yeah. So it wasn't too bloody from what
Wait, how did you see it if you were like 15? I thought this was like a PG-13 movie. Yeah.
That's what I was saying. I remember sitting with a friend after a day at school. I don't even remember, to be honest. I just remember going. But And I remember it having a large impact on me.
But it's, okay, remember. Yeah. It is, yeah, it's rated R.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I saw Rated R movies all the time when I was younger, but I mean, just because my parents like to see Rated R movies.
Yeah, that's because your parents took you. Yeah. I remember trying, oh God, my first Rated R movie that I've, so me and one of my other friends were because you have to be 17, mm-hmm. We're 17, and then our other friend was like 2 days shy of her 17th birthday, and we really wanted to go see Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which was Rated R, and we couldn't go see it.
Wait, May 2008, yeah, I was only 16.
Interesting. I guess they were just like, we're not even going to bother. They didn't really care about that kind of shit in 2008, I'll be honest.
I mean, it was in the middle of the day kind of thing. Like, that's what made it so funny. It was like, I'm pretty sure I went with my friend, like, after a day at school, and she was probably a senior, so she would have been over 17.
Oh, she probably just bought you the ticket.
That makes sense. Yeah. We cracked it.
Oh, no.
Case uncovered.
It was before.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that's how it went, but I don't know. I don't exactly remember. It wasn't that big of a deal. Mm. I can tell you, there was no one around. We're the only people in the theater.
It's like not like back. Or it, like that's. That was then, because now, like, anytime you try to buy a rated R, like, movie ticket, they're like, we're going to check your ticket, we're going to check your ID if you look like you're underage, like, we are going to be assholes about this.
I should also clarify, this is in Arizona. Fair enough. Is, like, a lot less.
Arizona is a lot, and sentence.
Just a lot, and it's less in a lot of ways.
Although, okay, really quickly, my thoughts on the movie.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to like this movie so much because it was one of those movies that I saw when I was a kid that I saw trailers for.
Yeah, I was wanting to see it.
That looked supremely my shit because, again, love true crime.
Yeah.
And I never saw it, and I kind of just never, like, I was, and then as I got older and started actually watching horror movies legitimately, I was like, okay, well, now this just looks, like, kind of dumb. And watching it, I wanted to like it. I thought it was very dumb. I was also very high, though. And I was telling Anthony this yesterday. I was just like, I really just want a compilation of Liv Tyler, like, saying protagonist's male names, like her co-stars, like in, like, a breathy voice, because that's all she does in these movies. Like, it was between this and, like, The Incredible Hulk and, like, Lord of the Rings.
I thought that, too. I was like, all she does is whisper. Like, Jesus. Like,
I kept trying.
I think that's just her talking voice.
That's true.
Yeah, that's the fucking problem. But anyway, so those are my thoughts. Like, I wanted to like it. It was enjoyable. It lost me at parts. Like, I was definitely checking my phone throughout. Mm-hmm. Like, I was not, like, sucked into the movie like I wanted to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was also one of those things, like, if someone knocked at my door at 4:00 in the morning, I would simply leave. Like, I would, like, if they did that and was just like, is Tamara home? And then I would just be like, who the fuck are you? And then I would leave. Like, I wouldn't give them the
opportunity there,
If I recognize someone is starting to case my home, I simply remove myself from the situation. Take my shit. I'm not dying today.
All right. I was going to say more, but then I'll probably just get into it too much longer. I don't know. I totally agree with that. And it's kind of sad that a movie that impacted me so much as a kid, I look back at it now and I'm like, well, I mean, it does play off more like a true crime documentary. But there are points of it where you're just like, you want to roll your eyes and... Yeah. That's kind of stupid.
Your tastes change. It happens to me all the time. Hell, for movies we watched when we probably first started this podcast, if you look back, it might be worse.
I've listened to some old episodes and I'm like, I don't agree with myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yes.
And it's so only funny. Been 3 years. So anyway, let's wrap this up.
Yeah. What would you guys rate The Strangers out of 5 failed marriage proposals?
2.5, straight down the middle.
Straight down the middle?
Yeah.
You read my mind, Webster. Straight down the fucking middle also. Yeah, 2.5 for me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean...
Sorry, I don't know. I don't know what I would do. You give your explanation, Anthony.
To me, well, I watched it. I put my phone away. It was completely dark. I did the whole nighttime viewing. I, like, made a thing of it. You know, it's a very, very flawed movie. But it still has scenes that work. So to me, that's a down-the-middle horror right there. That's kind of the best you can hope for. So, yeah.
The best you can hope for, God.
For something so simple without a lot of substance. It's like, true. Yeah, to me, it's like, if it does some things effective, but overall, it's like, it's, you know, it's not great.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right down the middle for me.
There were parts that I liked, and there were parts that I disliked. Overall, like, I think it's a makeout movie.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Like, I feel like if I, yeah, I think, like, that this is just a movie that, like, I would just get really baked and just, like, make out to the entire time if I was, like,
oh, they're killing each other now. Oh,
okay, cool. Like, it's background noise, like, I feel like, is a movie. It's, like, a horror film. But, like, that doesn't necessarily make it bad because I've called so many films on this movie, on this podcast, makeout movie.
That's true. Sometimes you're doing something, you look up. And there you go. You're entertained and you can get back to it.
And it's just like, oh, cool. And then it's just like, all right. You know, like, sometimes you need to take a water break, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, 2.5, straight down the middle for me.
Oh, that's funny. I don't know. I don't really watch as much horror as I used to. I think I used to be a lot more into it. And now I've noticed that as I've gotten older, the idea, like, hearing, like, knives get stabbed into people really, really upsets me. Yeah. Like, it, like, really hits my nerves in a way that it didn't used to. And I don't know. It's a lot harder for me now to watch horror in general. But what was funny about that is I was expecting this movie that had such an impact on me when I was younger to play out that way when I was watching it. And it didn't. And maybe I watched a version that had a lot of things edited out. But I don't know. I was pretty... I can see, like, where all the critic, like, stuff came from, you know? But, yeah, like you said, it's still effective. There are still moments that I think were, like, that. It's still an iconic shot because it is iconic where he walks in with that mask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, out of the shadows and stuff. And that's a really... The fact that to get that kind of iconic look in the culture at all for a horror film was hard. So, for that reason... I think I'm gonna give it a 3.
Because, all right,
there you go.
You know, I think it. You know, I'm not as embarrassed as I used to be that this is a really impactful movie because you can see it. And if I had the volume on louder, it probably would have been better.
God, the volume was so loud on my TV for some weird reason when I was watching it.
It seemed kind of inconsistent, like the voices versus like the music and the violin coming in.
I think the sound editor was like having a chill day in the studio when he was editing this.
Wasn't fixing his levels properly.
No.
Nah.
Okay. I think that's it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us, Kathleen. This was so much fun.
I know. We're all post-hangover high, good...
Just chilling, good vibes. Just good vibes.
Yeah, this was really fun.
Okay, so this was The Strangers from 2008. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Next week, you got a taste of it today.
You did.
Of my stupid high brain. But next week is 420, so I think you know what that means. I think we've actually mentioned it by name before earlier in the season of like what movie we're thinking about covering for, you know, this blessed
our
holiday.
Our first 420 episode.
Yeah, it just happened to work out. 420 is on Tuesday, so...
Maybe you'll get it early.
Maybe you'll get it early. Maybe you won't. It really just depends on our schedules and when we can set aside a couple hours of getting high. But, yeah, so join us next week for that. And if you like what you heard, please consider giving us a 5-star rating on iTunes and subscribing or following wherever you're listening. It does help other people find this fine podcast, and you guys are the absolute fucking best for doing it, and I love you to the end of the world.
I agree with most of that, yes.
For doing it. Yeah, you guys are the best. And then if you'd like to stay up to date on the latest and greatest on all of our podcast shenanigans, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are on Facebook and Twitter at Horror People Pod, and we are on Instagram at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORRORBLE People's Podcast. And then you can find Anthony on Twitter and Instagram at Hyrulean Hustler. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ghost Coffee Shop. Yeah, I think that's it.
I think that does it. Kathleen, would you like to plug anything?
Do you have anything you'd like to promote?
No, nothing to plug at the moment.
All right.
Living my life mostly without that right now.
Probably for the best.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that though. Can I just say, Anthony, it was so funny. Like the reason why we talked about doing this at first, this was months ago that we talked about me joining.
Yeah, to see if she wanted to try it out.
Yeah, because we were talking about doing a stupid podcast ourselves. This is not stupid. Like, but you get what I mean.
But no, I totally get it.
The podcast space sounds stupid in general whenever you're thinking about doing it. And But this was really fun, and you guys have a really great format.
Oh,
thank you.
It was such a joy to join the conversation. You guys know so much, and I learned a lot, and I loved it. So awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming. Yeah,
thank
we appreciate it. And again, you have a wonderful podcast voice.
You do.
Yeah, it's right there.
It's great.
I need you to keep explaining really things. Nice. I will listen.
That is really nice to know, because I'm also high, so I feel like I'm worried when I watch this back, I'm going to be like, oh, God, that sounds so stupid. You fucking rambled.
No, it'll be fun. It'll be fun for all of us. And
yeah, for sure. No,
it's okay. But I'm editing it. It'll be precise.
Yeah, it'll be like, to the fucking point. Okay. Yes. So we're just going to wrap it up.
Best.
I know. He's the best. All right. Bye, guys.
See you guys.
Bye.